What is up, everybody? It is Tuesday, and a Tuesday means one thing. It is Orion Podcast Night. I am Chad Brock.
And I'm Zach Bailiff.
And you're tuned in to the right place. Let's go. And the USA sticker gets me, just gets me every time. What's up, man? So, like, gosh, it doesn't even feel like we had Snooki on, but like 5 minutes ago, honestly.
I know. And I've been in Indiana twice since then and ain't seen you once yet.
Yeah, dude. Like, super wild. These last 2 weeks have literally flown by. I guess I did it. I guess it's because my doc talk got shifted to last week. So, like, I have no gap.
Yeah.
Zero gaps.
It's been all gas, no brakes the last couple of weeks. So, just trying to stay ahead of the curve on things and get photos pushed out, stay caught up with everything.
Yeah, you're getting there. Had some good photos though, man. Birthday parties gotta have good photos for birthday party. And they called the right guy.
Yeah,
why'd you drive him off a long way?
Nobody called. I just showed up with a camera bag and took it upon myself because I knew it needed done. But yeah, in Indiana, a total of 30 hours each trip.
Yeah, with an 8-hour drive.
Yeah, well, 16 total when you drive back. Yeah, so 16. Yeah.
that's fun. It makes for the weekends interesting. Then you just get to do it again one more time here at the end of the month.
Yep, that'll be a 4-day though, so that'll be a little better.
Yeah, a little better. Yeah,
I got some work to do on that trip. I got some mineral to get out. So
mineral to get out. The things are greening up here in Indiana, and it is a beautiful sight. The boats hit the water. They've been fishing. I mean. You might actually come home at like the right time for the Easter celebration, and I should be back with some new toys. I got a meeting that I'm coming back, so
possible.
Be back for that weekend.
I should have two bow boxes here possibly tomorrow, so that'll be a nice little birthday present to open the door to around 1 o'clock, but.
No,
lots of content to create around those. So it's going to be a busy year. It's looking good though.
You want me to sing to you?
No, I'm good. I'm good.
Okay. Yeah. We might be able to talk our esteemed guest into it. We haven't done an episode like this since episode number two, when we had Mr. Nick Troutman on. I'm kind of excited about it because, dude, I feel like we always learn something when we have guests that do different things than what you and I are into, and we kind of get to see a light into the way someone else does it, and that's always a good thing. But our guest tonight, so he's got accolades, Team USA freestyle, gold medals, like, I mean, just dishing them out. I don't know what else to say. He's well accomplished. You guys in the Jackson family know this guy pretty well. But let's welcome the one, the only, Mr. Clay Wright. I got to get my button back. What's up, Clay?
Hey, guys. What's up?
What's going on?
Oh, man. We are happy. Whoa, happy to have you here.
Well,
hold
you.
On here. I'm not supposed to be in the big block.
He's all kinds of discombobulated.
Yeah, my mouse is not working very well at all today. I don't know why. There it is. I think the battery is about dead. It happens. So how is the beautiful weather down in Tennessee? I assume you're in Tennessee right now.
Yeah, it's absolutely perfect. It was nice and warm today. It was probably like 60 degrees and raining. And we needed the rain real bad. The water was just getting ready to shut off here at Rock Island. We've been having a lot of good play levels, like 3,000. And then it turned off to 1,500 right when we got out. And it was just pouring down rain. So there's no way it's going to be 1,500 tomorrow.
Yeah.
That'll be great.
Well, rain.
And, like, for those of you who haven't seen Rock Island and its magnitude of, like, what this place is, it is, it's actually very spectacular. If you ever get a chance to go to Rock Island and check it out, highly recommend, 10 out of 10. And you just might see these guys down there doing their thing, or you might see some of the rest of us downstream just a little bit catching some fish. It's a pretty cool JK test facility, to say the least.
Well, it's a real short stretch of whitewater between two dams. We're so lucky that they built the dams a little ways away and saved all the gradient. So we've got, when the dam is open, we've got a 20-foot waterfall and a class 5 rapid, and then we've got the waves and holes for when they're just generating. And then when they're not doing any of that, we got some nice little fish holes and some nice swimming areas.
Nice. It's beautiful at that. Great Falls is awesome. And like I said, for anybody that's ever looking for a little quick trip, sneak over there, get a little sneak in, and you'll be glad you did. You can go stand on there over the overlooks and take some photos. And again, you might just see these guys down there doing their thing. You guys just had a big birthday party down there too. So there's a good paddling night here for the birthday party.
Yeah, it was Eric Jackson's birthday, and he had a lot of people come in to celebrate with him, and that was really fun, having a lot of our real friends around. We had like 7 people on the water a bunch of times, a lot of people at his house who didn't take the water. It was fun. We've been playing here, forever, and it went from completely empty, nobody else playing here, and then EJ showed up, which was great, and then lots of people showed up, which was less great. And now it's back down to almost rarely seeing anybody. Today, the other group on the water just barely missed the water, which was sad. We saw them just as we were walking out. They were walking down, and the water was just dropping.
Mm-hmm. Oh, man. So, Clay, you have been doing this for a good minute now. You've been around, to say the least, and seen so many places, and it got a lot of great stories. But the real story that I think that Zach and I want to tell tonight, and as we always do with the Roll Ryan podcast, the first question out of the gate here for you, man, is how did the sport of whitewater kayaking find you? Like, what brought you into this, and how did you fall in love with it and this journey throughout the outdoors?
Oh, well, in the world, my parents got into it. My aunt and uncle were from Nashville, Tennessee, and they got into whitewater canoeing back in the 70s, kind of the deliverance wave of canoeists and the Tennessee Scenic Rivers Association and that sort of thing. My stepfather was a president of the Tennessee Scenic Rivers Association. My aunt was a president of the Tennessee Scenic Rivers Association. So we were big club boaters. Mom really loved it. And, I grew up with the whole house smelling like fiberglass because they were building boats in the basement. And I got signed up for an explorer's post so that I could go with Dick Wooten on a Colorado trip. He was taking teenagers to Colorado every summer for like a 2-week trip. And unfortunately, the first time they deemed me not quite good enough to run a lot of the stuff, which was really infuriating because I could roll really, really well in a pool, but I wasn't that good on the river. I was like, mean, and maybe I swam with him or maybe I didn't swim with him, but I was just scared to swim. And so I didn't get to paddle that much. And so then the next time I went out, I made sure I was ready. I grew up doing a lot of hanging out and watching other people paddle because I was just too young. Mm-hmm. So we would go to the Nantahala or to the Ocoee And either there would be other kids to hang out with, or sometimes they wouldn't, or sometimes, you know, somebody's girlfriend would watch over me while the rest of them went paddling. But I did a lot of time hanging out at Nantahala Falls or Hellhole while my parents were on the water with my aunts and uncles canoeing. And then with my cousins, I got more interested in paddling. They were learning to roll, and we got imported Klepper Minor kayaks, which was, I guess, the first kid's kayak, and they were imported from Germany by somebody or other. We all had the same little kayaks, and we started going down the Hiawassee.
It's awesome, man. That is awesome. So talk about those first kayaks, and I mean, you know, first kids' kayaks. I mean, what was those like compared to what you've got now? I mean, it had to be wild.
They had to be short and smaller overall because they were for little kids. They were for little kids, but they were still 11 foot long, and they had a nice V-shaped hull. They were basically flat water boats. They were basically like fiberglass kids' versions of fold boats. So it had a long V-shaped pointy deck. The grab loops were just barely above the waterline. I mean, it was much of a cigar as you could possibly get, but just really downsized for kids. And the foot braces was an aluminum bar between two little mounts on the inside, but I was too small. I couldn't reach them. So back then, that was just the way you did it, is you took a broomstick and you cut it down to fit, and then you hammered it down into the bottom of the boat. So that was what you used for a bulkhead, was a broomstick hammered down into the bottom of the boat. And then they would glue either foam or they would fiberglass it in place. And if you grew, they took it out and moved it.
Dang. That's wild, dude. Yeah. I mean, especially when I mean, getting to see what we have now, it's crazy to think that, I mean, of course, not similar, but not similar. I mean, I can remember my dad bringing home a motorcycle, dude. And he was like, I was like, Dad, I can't touch the ground. I can't start this thing. And he's like, it'll be all right. Once you get it started off that bucket, you don't need to put your feet down again. So
yeah, I was really lucky in that they had come out with kids' versions of kayaks. I was less lucky because they didn't have a lot of good kayak gear for kids. But that was the challenging part. What everyone else was wearing was hockey helmets, because they didn't really make helmets just for kayaking. They did have some of those early Setas, but not many people had those. I had some sort of, maybe some people had Roamers. I think, I don't remember what I had, but it didn't fit at all. So I put a sponge in it. My life jacket was a horse collar for the first little while that I went paddling. Those orange things that go around your neck, and you buckle them down. I wore a woman's wetsuit because it was the smallest one that we could find. But then, of course, it had these boobs built into it. So somebody made a joke one day that I should put my lunch in it. And then
that's where my head went, was snacks. So
yeah, that was a pretty place to put your apples and your peanut butter crackers and that sort of stuff. Wore a raincoat over a wool sweater the first couple times. Because there was no real anything else. And so my early memories of kayaking was that I liked the river. I liked the idea of the whole kayaking, but I didn't actually like being freezing cold all day. So anytime we did the Hiawassee, I would just freeze. And, you know, everybody in the canoes didn't understand that you're floating around in an ice box. The boat quickly becomes whatever the water temperature is. Whereas the canoers are a lot higher out of the water, so they would be a lot warmer. So kayaking, I didn't really love it that much at first. I liked the idea of it, but it was so associated with my teeth chattering and my hands not working. And then, you know, I'm not sure when the dry top came around. Patagonia made one, and Stolquist, CKS, made one. And eventually I got one of those when they came out, and that kind of changed my world, because you could put that over the new fleece instead of wool. Turns out I'm allergic to wool, which was not a great thing.
Oh, wow.
I was wearing it anyway, but I would get, like, you know, itchy rashes around my necks and stuff. So the fleece came out, and that was great. Then I could actually paddle and be warmer. And I think that's really when my skills really took off, because then I could not worry about flipping over. I got my roll down super good because I wasn't scared to do it, Because, you know, otherwise, you know, especially if you're a little kid and everyone tells you to show off your role at the put-in, and you do, but you're in a raincoat and a wool sweater, so the water pours in your boat, and then you're soaked and freezing the rest of the day. A whole rest of the river, I wouldn't want to flip. And so that was kind of the what was really holding me back, I think, was the idea that anytime you flip means you're going to be cold the rest of the day. So I just got really scared of flipping, and that dry top changed everything, because then all of a sudden it was like, wow, I can like do enders and stuff and I'm still not cold. This is great.
Now, do you remember that first run, dude? Like when it just things clicked for you?
I remember a couple different things. I had one really scary run where I didn't realize that I should wear my glasses, because everybody just left their glasses behind back then. And I paddled into a tree, and you know, the people who were trying to save me, their canoe went under a rock and they swam. And then nobody could get to me because I was in the trees. So eventually I think my stepfather just like waded into the water and helped me off the tree. But then they told me on the next Colorado trip, I think it was, everybody was running rivers and they were making me stay in the car. They were like, well, you don't really have a good roll, so you can't really run this. I think it was the Crystal in Colorado. I was kind of like, I have a roll. I have a really good roll. I can roll. But then I eventually had to kind of prove it. So they let me run some section of Whitewater. And I just thought, you know, now's the time. You've got to, instead of being the person who everyone wants to go kayaking and you're like, no, it's cold, I don't know if I want to go today. It shifted the gears, because it wasn't my parents trying to make me go anymore. It was not my parents. It was an Explorer post with other kids in it telling me that I couldn't go because I wasn't good enough. So suddenly that connection between being good and showing people that you're good was made. I didn't realize that was such a challenging thing to do, and that such an important part of your paddling. If people think you're not very good, then you're not going to get invited. If they think you're really good, you're going to get invited everywhere. So I made it my mission on that trip to, you know, try things I'd never done and to roll in between the rapids and roll on the wave trains and just, you know, peel out of an eddy and fall upside down and roll up, just to show everybody that I could do this and that I wasn't going to be a drag to the trip. And that trip really changed my life. All of a sudden I was one of the group and I could go. And it was just a different place to be in the lineup. And now that once I valued that and really wanted to make sure that people knew any skill I had, I wanted to show it off to hopefully get invited on the next trip. And I've been using that to get invited on trips ever since.
Now we got an audience question from, looks like Jalen. It's hard to see. I need to put my glasses on. It says, Clay, what year are you talking about? I mean, when you first got going in the kayak. So what age were you? Kind of what year?
I'm born in 67, and I was 7 when I was learning to roll and going on the Hiwassee. I think I did the Hiwassee. We tried to do some section of the Hiwassee in canoes with my cousin, who was also 6, and we just had a terrible time because we just went flying down the river and couldn't stop. And then when I was 7, they got us those kayaks, and we did in kayaks instead, but didn't have, I got my roll in a pool, but I couldn't do it on the river, and I couldn't get the skirt off. So Tom Pop, actually a Chattanooga boater who was really good, he was in charge of us, and he would just flip us back upright if we fell over. And I don't know what 7 plus 67 would be, 74, 75. Mm-hmm. So the gear was coming along rapidly by the time the 80s hit. And that's when I think a lot more people were kayaking, a lot more people were getting good at kayaking. Eventually, I started going with, you know, you'd be on the Ocoee and people would be doing these pirouettes at Slice and Dice and stuff. And, you know, I really wanted to be one of those guys, but I was in a canoe club, so I didn't really have anyone else doing that sort of things. But our canoe club, I got lucky. my parents, my aunts and uncles, and my canoe club all progressed. They went at it really hard. They went every weekend. You know, the Ocoee became like just what we did on every weekend. The Obed system, the Chattooga, any other rivers. And pretty soon we were going to the Gali and the New River. And we did the Grand Canyon, all with this big group of open boaters and just a couple of us in kayaks. But it meant that I got a lot of experience with people, you know, pinning boats and swimming long rapids and not being able to roll. They could all roll, but they didn't necessarily do it because canoe is a lot harder. So there was a big safety element that we had in our group that by the time I went to college and I just got super lucky with college. I went to Davidson College in North Carolina and my roommate was a paddler. I was pretty stoked about that. But opening day, I find out my advisor is a paddler. It was Chris Bell, who later went on the board of the American Whitewater. And he took me to a cookout. And I was a squirt boater at the time, paddling, you know, whatever squirt boat I had, which was one of the super early ones. And these guys were out in flat water playing in the squirt. And then they had a barbecue for all the squirt boaters who would come over to play. And it was Woody Calloway and Risa Shimoda. And she was the president of American Whitewater. And he was just a really, really good boater who, you know, within a couple of years got a job working for Perception Kayaks and traveling around the country demoing boats. So I just really got lucky with that relationship of, you know, myself being really, really just totally fixated on kayaking, wanting everything I could do to go every day. And all of a sudden just running into some of the top names in the sport in a really sort of organic, just a way that sort of works. They were people who were going mm-hmm. kayaking and I wanted to paddle with them. And then, you know, one of our first trips was the Russell Fork. And I mean, it was just blew my mind. We're unloading these boats off the top of their van and they're like super, super thin and have glitter all over the deck. And they're putting on these glittered helmets. And it was like, these boats are the smallest things I've ever seen humans fit in. And we're going on the Russell Fork, which is supposed to be really hard. And it was, they were just really good. And they had a whole crew of people who was all really good. Met Doug Wellman, Bob McDonough, all sorts of super good paddlers on that day. Me and my dancer with my, you know, oh gosh, what was it? A Pro-Tec helmet, orange. Had my Saita high float life jacket. My Norse paddle, aluminum mm-hmm. staff, fiberglass. I was definitely out of fashion for times, but they were really nice about the whole thing. They were fine. They were basically like, you know, if you help set safety and you don't take up any of our time, then you're good to go. Let's go. So they really sort of ushered me through that transition from upper level club boater of thinking that we're going to stop at every rapid and set ropes at every single spot and maybe bring a lunch and maybe make a fire and have, like, you know, it wasn't like sit around singing Kumbaya or anything, but it was definitely a little bit different of a thing between those guys who were saying, you know, we need to kind of keep moving so that we'll get a second lap before the water shuts off. That also just kind of blew my mind because I was like, wait, we're going to go back up and do it again? You can do that? Yeah, this is badass. And we could go really fast because nobody ever had to empty their boat. It was all kayaks.
So when you look back and you think about where you come from and where you're at now, I mean, do you feel like these early moments and these early times with maybe not the best gear and not the best boat, you know, really molded you into the paddler that you are today? Or do you feel like it was more the relationships and the teachings that were coming from these well-known paddlers that, you know, helped influence your path?
I would say the gear was just a challenge. Anybody who's trying to get kids into boating, I think you don't have to buy the newest, best gear or any of that stuff. I don't think that you can expect them to handle cold water very well and enjoy themselves. that was a good lesson that I pass on a lot. If you want your kids to get into whitewater, don't take them to the Hiawassee and with no gear. Even if it's in summer, they're going to freeze. And you might not realize that when you're in all your gear, but if they don't have any gear, they're going to freeze in that cold water. Kids just get cold easy. But then I also had my stepfather in particular, and just all the people around us, we had to be really safe because it was canoes. And it was really early in the days of whitewater when there wasn't a whole lot of, there was no William Neely book. There were no videos. My stepfather started shooting videos with an early camera, but it was just, you know, you shot your trip. There certainly wasn't an instructional guide besides the, was it the Bob Benner Basic River Canoeing book? I think it was a Bob Benner. Anyway, Basic River Canoeing. It had really basic stuff for people in fold boats and stuff. So there just wasn't that much knowledge about what the current did or how to do rescues. And so I happened to be, you know, sort of born into or married into a person who knew all about that. He knew all about how to unpin a canoe and where they were going to pin and how to lean into the current and what waves and holes do. He was really ahead of the game in water reading for the groups that we were with, you know, compared to my aunts and uncles and the people that my mom had been paddling before that. And so that was a really neat thing for me is to, you know, be on the inside, have the ear of somebody who was really understanding whitewater in a very different way. And also planning, not just to run the rapid, but his goal, you know, his job in our group, being one of the best paddler, was always to figure out where someone was going to mess up and plan for it. And so that safety aspect, I think, really put me in a good position to suddenly go with really top-end paddlers who didn't swim that often. I think one of the ways that I got sort of invited back to be in the cool kid group with all those squirt boaters and all those people who were really good at creek boating was because, you know, I went down and I set a rope at triple drop. It looked horrible. And I was just like, people are going to swim here. And they did. And I roped them out. And I think that was, you know, that kind of opened the doors a little bit for me of being a part of the group that would actually help people instead of just have to listen to the lines and be sort of a drag. So I think that really got my foot in the door with the group of really good paddlers is when they realized that I was actually going to try to keep everybody in the group safe a little bit in addition to just, you know, either portage or follow my way down the river with them.
You mentioned kind of him being able to read the water and stuff there. I would imagine that's one of the big learning curves, especially in, you know, whitewater is really kind of learning what the water is doing as much on top as it is underneath.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you can read the water, you don't have to paddle as hard and you don't have to worry quite so much about what's about to happen. The better your water reading skills, the safer kayaking is overall by far. If you're running something because other people are running it and you're thinking, oh, well, I start right and it seems to be going well for everyone else, that might be great. But it's a lot better to be thinking, not I'm going to start on the right, but more like nothing really matters on this rapid except for being within 4 feet of this rock with a 45 degree angle to the right. And after that, I'm home free. And you don't really have to worry about all the other stuff. You're just thinking there's one undercut on this rapid. And to miss it, I do this. And then you can just kind of like, it's very casual at that point. Instead of the people who are literally trying to start from the left and drive right the whole way down the rapid and in hopes that they will still have that angle when they go by the rock. So you can simply use your brain and overcome a lot of strength and a lot of paddling and a lot of worry. Because if you know, oh, this rapid is actually super dangerous, I don't care to run it because it's not that fun and it's super dangerous. And this other one that everyone's worried about, it's kind of like, well, you know, it's big and it's violent, but you're going to go right through that hole. Who cares? Then your strength level just stays a lot lower and you can focus on the things that are actually a problem. And you're able to, you know, use your brain to find interesting things to do with the water instead of just have worry at every single rapid of, is this rock a problem? it's a lot easier when you look at the rock and you say, like, well, that one's a problem and that one's not a problem. And so I don't care about this rock. I'm going to go ram into it as hard as I can just for fun, but I'm going to avoid that rock and everything else is safe. So once you start making judgment calls like that, kayaking is a lot safer, but also it opens the doors to have more fun because you start figuring out which rocks you can play with or make games to like see if you can get in front of it. But if you don't, you don't care. So I think having a child's body when you learn whitewater and having no strength to use can be a real asset. Because you've got to use the current. You can't overcome. You can't just muscle it across a big ferry. Like, I remember the word ferry to me was like a scary thing. Every time someone said, okay, we're going to ferry over here, I would think, oh my God, these are the ones where I always mess up. I don't know how to ferry. Well, it wasn't that I didn't know how to ferry. It was that I was in an 11-foot, you know, lawn dart of a kayak. If I blew my angle, there was no getting it back. And plus, those guys were in 13-foot boats with like 3 or 4 times the power and speed that I had. So if I blew that initial peel out, I was toast, and I was going downstream fast. So pretty quickly, I started having to read the water a little bit better. So they would say, we're going to ferry over to the river right. And all the canoes and all the other people would just look at the eddy on the river right. And I would immediately turn downstream and be like, okay, how am I going to run this? Because there's a good chance I'm not going to make the ferry. So let's just go ahead and figure out what's about to happen here. Or sometimes I would get out of my boat, walk upstream, and go for the ferry somewhere else. So I started having to make my own decisions because I couldn't do the same things as everyone around me. And a lot of times the adults wouldn't realize you couldn't do it. Mm-hmm. They would think, oh, you've got a good roll. You can make this ferry. And they didn't understand the size difference and the equipment difference. So I think kids that learn to paddle at a young age, it's a big challenge. But all of a sudden, your body grows a little bit, your muscles grow a little bit, and you've got this super better developed brain, plus all the power of everyone else, and it's a great combo.
So yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, for sure. And that kind of feeds back into a little bit what we talked about in that episode we did with Nick. And, you know, he was talking a little bit about the scouting and the different thing that they did to go over the falls. And that was really impressive, the time and the thought, the different things that went into it to make it sure, you know, that they would have a good, safe run when they did stuff like that. But as we move forward, so we've kind of taken you up to those college days. At what point, like, did you really start that hardcore training, like, and start setting goals within kayaking to graduate yourself to those next levels?
I never thought I'm going to be a super competitive kayaker. I really just wanted to be good. I wanted to impress the people that I was so impressed with. I wanted to be able to have the mastery. It would be a little bit more like a kung fu sort of thing. I guess I had Woody Calloway and some of his friends as sort of my masters. I didn't tell them that. It wasn't that kind of thing, but I was definitely kind of like, I want to be able to look like they do when they kayak. And that was my main focus. And when they were doing a freestyle rodeo, on the Ocoee and saying, we're all going to do the Ocoee. I was kind of like, oh yeah, I'll go do the Ocoee. Whatever you guys are doing this weekend, I'm in. And then all of a sudden there you are and there's like, oh God, I don't know what trick score and there's going to be judges and there's going to be all these people watching me. This is completely not what I wanted to do this weekend. But you suck it up because you realize, well, they do this and they're really good. So maybe I should do this and maybe that'll help me get better. And then there was a Watauga race and I didn't even know the lines of the Watauga, but I wanted to show that I was willing to be in that group and to be one of those people who did things like that. And so I had to ask, I just said, you know, I really want to do this and I want to be a part of the race and show people that we can race the Watauga, but I don't know where I'm going. Is there any options? Can I follow somebody? And they were like, oh yeah, follow Psycho. So I met a really good canoer at the time, Dave Simpson. And I followed him on the Watauga race. And of course, somebody right off the bat said, he's not going to go very fast, but it'll be perfect because you don't know the line, so you can just kind of do the race course. But then right when I lined up with him, he said something like, I know it's about to happen here. You're going to pass me right at the finish line. And I don't remember. I think I successfully didn't do that. But that was a really neat thing, is to see these people who were so into racing. But when you said, I'll sign up, but I really can't do this. And then they figured it out for you. So it was a very social event. I would say both the freestyle, the Ocoee Rodeo at that time of year, that time in history, and the Watauga race at that time in history were very open to welcoming people who were going to be out of their element and not very good. But they were very open to saying, we will tell you what to do. I can remember one of the Ocoee Rodeos, I think Susan Wilson, I was like, I don't even know what the tricks are that you guys are doing. And she's like, well, here's the easiest, highest scoring trick. I'm going to teach it to you right now. And she showed me how to do one-arm bandits both ways. She's like, now you've got a trick. You can do something. And I did it, and it was great. Then all of a sudden, these same people are all orchestrating a world championships on the Ocoee. And that point, I was out of college and had gone to West Virginia to be a video boater. I got out of college, and I literally just said, I can't go to law school right now. Bought a van, drove to California. Unfortunately, I hyperextended both knees, paddling my squirt boat in the ocean, like right off the bat. Like, went to Stinson Beach. This is going to be so great. And just peed on the sand and ejected out the top. I tried surfing way too big of waves when I really didn't know much about the ocean. But anyway, so I didn't get to paddle much in California, but I did end up going to West Virginia to video boat, which was amazing. I mean, can you imagine? You're looking at getting summer jobs or winter jobs, or just trying to make ends meet, ski bummed in the winter, and then they're like, oh, they're paying $100 to paddle the Gauley every day with a video camera. And I was kind of like, I can do this. This sounds like a job tailor made for me. I know how to use a video camera, and I want to paddle the Gauley every day. So, yeah, all of a sudden I was paddling the Gauley every day, all Gauley season long. And those guys were having rodeos on the Ocoee. And then it was a world championships, and all these people came to the Ocoee from all over the world. I met all these people. I was the alternate for the team in 93, and I got to announce and judge. And just kind of surrounded by my friends doing really well, which was super fun to watch and super fun to be a part of. And then I guess just ever since, that was kind of like a part of kayaking to me. You know, there was creek boating, which was fun, and there was rodeo, which was fun, and there was squirt boating, which was fun, and there was doing, you know, hiking a long way and doing the maps and trying to find a first ascent or a river that nobody had done, or just a river doing it faster. All these different things were just kind of what we did in that group. And so I kept doing it.
That explains your story. Just what you've told of it so far explains a lot to me. And, you know, that was one of the things that when you and I stayed in Kentucky and we did the fun tour and you surfed what they called the church wave there on the Elkhorn, and watching you compared to what maybe I had seen through viral videos and the rest of our team, and me being an angler and being not in the know, really puts it in perspective on like how smooth I noticed that you were, and the way that you just like, you made it look so effortless when you was out there on that church wave. And it was just like, you just had a rhythm about you, and hearing your story like really brings that, and that just really fits into your style. You're just a smooth operator, dude.
Yeah, well, I would say that most of my first freestyle and surfing was done here in Rock Island or in West Virginia, but there was no time limit. You would get on a wave. Like, I can remember deciding someday that I was going to see if I could surf for 15 minutes straight, and then it was like, well, that wasn't that hard. I mean, there just weren't that many other people boating on the weekdays. So if you went out to surf a wave or to run a river on the weekdays, you kind of spent your whole day on the river. And that's kind of my formative years on really getting into doing tricks and surfing and that sort of thing. So I would do like a 4-minute ride sometimes to Rock Island on video. And it didn't even occur to me that that was a problem until we got really a lot more serious with the freestyle events. And people were like, you got to stop doing that. You know, you're not going to be ready to go fast. And then EJ moves here and he's like so focused on the 1-minute ride that I had to speed up a whole lot. And I, you know, I still like doing the 1-minute freestyle competitions and stuff, but a lot of my surfing, you know, just what I'm thinking about while I'm on the waves was formed before there was anybody really watching or scoring or waiting in line or any of that stuff. You'd catch a wave when you're video boating, and as long as there was a good window when there were no rafts around, you just surfed it until somebody else came downstream. But there was a lot of waves and not that many people, so you get real used to kind of surfing for you and just being out there and enjoying the flow of the water and stuff. So I think that is certainly not lost on anybody, but that was a much bigger part of surfing than the tricks and the hurrying has become for competition today.
Very well put. So, like, as far as keeping up, I mean, you got some grind, dude. You've kind of been in this game a long time. For these kids at home, how do you keep it going, man? Like, what do you do? I know you just got out of the gym before we started this podcast. What does Clay's routine look like to keep this truck trucking?
I'm kind of the realization has definitely hit home maybe 10 years ago or more that just kayaking, I used to pride myself on just kayaking is enough. You don't really have to do that much else as long as you just kayak hard all the time. But I got some overuse injuries in my shoulders. You know, the hyperextension in my knees that time really kind of came back to haunt me. And they're telling me to do these knee exercises to keep my knees tight and shoulder exercises to keep my shoulders tight. Abs and all that stuff. I had a hernia forever ago. I just been getting ripped back on a waterfall. EJ has this big discipline of doing a lot of working out and staying super fit and super strong. Mm-hmm. And for a while, I think I prided myself on not doing that, but being good anyway. But realistically, I don't think your body recovers nearly as fast unless it starts at a higher level. As you get older, you're just way more likely to injure yourself if you only use it going really fast with an impact sort of thing. Theo got really big into sit-ups and making his core super strong for the back injuries he knew he was going to be, you know, encountering with all his focus on waterfalls. And I was kind of like, oh, I think that makes a lot of sense. You better get a really strong core and get your shoulders ironed on pretty tight before you're going to be dropping into a 60-foot waterfall. And I also just noticed Jamie Simon was a world champion, Jaren Carroll, all the girls on whitewater, all the good girls in paddling did a lot of sit-ups. Mm-hmm. So weird. It's like a common denominator of the women's class that's not necessarily of the men's class, but then it is the men's class too. Nick Trautmann, Eric, Dane, everybody's doing sit-ups and trying to get their core pretty tight. And I think a big part of it is you just want to be able to make that kayak feel lighter. You want to do more with your kayak and with your body on the wave and have it all stay together and take a hit and come out unscathed. And to do that, you need to keep yourself fit. I'm not necessarily the person who's keeping themselves super fit. I don't go jogging. I don't do any of that sort of stuff because I don't just love it. But, you know, a flat water paddle at sunset is totally different. I don't have to think, oh, I need to do my cardio now. Sometimes I think, oh, I better do some cardio. But it's a lot easier for me to think, oh, the sun's going down. It's going to be so pretty on the lake. I better get out there. And then you throw the headphones on and you go do your sprint so you'll be in the best place to watch the sun go down. And it just feels good. That way you know, you're doing it, you're getting some cardio and it's fun. Like mountain biking is fun. Taking a walk with the dogs is fun. I think I've always been sort of addicted to finding a fun way to do that sort of thing. I mean, I haven't figured out how to do that with jogging or road biking or any of that stuff. So I don't do a lot of cardio.
I haven't figured it out for jogging either, obviously. I don't think Zach has either.
I don't know how.
I hate running.
If I don't get to go kayaking a day, or if I had a lame session or the water cut off or it just wasn't that good, sometimes physically I'm just not super happy at night. And I can go to the gym and in 30 minutes, I mean, you can do 30 minutes at the gym, 45 minutes at the gym, kind of pushing that same thing, like, oh, this is really boring. And you start doing, whatever it is, some machine or some weight, and you're like, oh, this is so boring. But by the second set or whatever, it kind of feels good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Endorphins kick in.
Addictive. Yeah,
that pump starts to come in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You just feel so much better. It's like some sort of endorphin gets released in your brain, and you kind of feel like you went kayaking, even though you didn't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, some of those sluggish workouts are the best. They end up being the best workouts, like the ones that you just don't want to be there, you don't want to go, and then they end up being like the best. I don't know why. It always happens.
I tried myself things to make myself do that a lot of times. And that has been working for me. Like for a while there, I was saying, if I go do something involving kayaking, plus do flat water, plus go to the gym, then I'm going to have a beer. And if I don't, I'm not. And it was kind of really fun. Because all of a sudden I started going a whole lot more. And now I don't even care if I have beer afterwards or not. I've finally put those things together. If like, man, if I can do, three things a day, that's, you just feel better.
100%.
And then when something runs, it's not like, oh my God, I can't believe this hike out is going to kill me. Now it's kind of like, I'm not really as worried about the hike out, and I'm not really as worried about carrying my boat a long way. And I'm not really worried about, pulling the boat up and over the rocks for the portage or any of that stuff. So it just makes kayaking funner, a little bit more like it was, when you're in your 30s and 40s and stuff. All that stuff is so much easier. And now that it's been getting harder, you're kind of like, oh, am I going to be the slowest one all the time? Am I going to have help on the portages? Am I going to be that guy? So now I'm totally open to the idea that I am going to be that guy. That's going to be me. I am going to be the slowest person up the hill and having trouble carrying my boat and having trouble carrying my kayak on a portage, but hopefully not yet.
Yeah, it becomes more fun when you know you're prepared for it, for sure.
Yeah, you don't want to be an inconvenience to everybody.
No.
I'm going to have to start buying lots of snacks and stuff for people to take out if they have to carry my boat.
Well, at least you're planning ahead that way.
Yeah. I'm planning ahead.
There you go. Now, let's talk about, we didn't really talk about, how'd you land here at Jackson Kayak?
I was working first for Dagger. My stepfather was a Dagger dealer, and I met those guys, and they were all super friendly, and I really liked Dagger as a company. Harriman, Tennessee, really close to here. I would go over there and get foam and hang out with the guys. But when this freestyle thing happened, I was really into squirt boating, and the freestyle thing is going on, and they were deciding that they weren't going to be a part of it. And that was kind of hard to hear, because I was so, it was probably a millisecond of right when I got out of college, but there's the cruise control out from Waves, New Wave, and somebody presented me with a stunt bat, a piranha boat that was a lot like a super cut down slalom boat. It's 11 feet long, super, super small, but you could stern squirt it and you could do bow enders everywhere. It was a lot more like a plastic version of the squirt boat that I'd started in. I mean, it was just so freaking fun. I brought it straight to Dagger and they said, we'll never make anything like that. That was a challenge, but then I ended up going to paddle a perception boat for a little bit and then Piranha, hooked up with Piranha, and they had just a wave after wave of awesome playboats coming out. They had a 7.5-foot kayak. Piranha was on fire back in the 90s. And that was so freaking fun. And then all of a sudden I got hired by Perception, which was a lot easier than flying to England to work on boats. and Perception was a huge opportunity. Got to work with both Woody and Risa in a professional environment and have an RV and drive around the country. So that was like living high on the hog. But then Perception crashed. We didn't sell as many kayaks as we were spending on marketing and other things, and they decided to fold the brand. So all of a sudden, I had no kayak company. But I had other sponsors and other things that I was doing with, selling rack space on the roof and selling advertisers for all the events I was going to and this sort of thing. EJ was having Wave Sport. So when he left Wave Sport and wanted to start a kayak company, he was already living here. I mean, what a crazy dream that is. You're like, oh, I love Rock Island and I love paddling with my cousins and stuff. But then my cousin's not paddling, not into freestyle like I was. And Eric Jackson shows up and paddles a couple times. And then he starts parking the RV here and paddling a lot. So this was like dream come true. This guy is so good, so strong, really different. We were very different paddlers, I would say. I was a lot more into creek boating and did some freestyle and squirt boating. And he was a lot more into the freestyle and the slalom and training and warming up and being strong and being fit and that sort of stuff. So it was super cool when he started a kayak company right here. It just seemed like not only a no-brainer, but almost like it had been written and that was just what was going to happen. So that was super fun. Not only did I get to work with somebody completely different on kayaks who had really a much higher level of understanding about what he wanted to do with the hulls and to make them work on waves and that sort of stuff. He was like really, really into that with his partner, David Knight. And I was a lot more, had been focused on in the R&D world about what to do with the decks and that sort of thing, just because that's, I don't know. Someone else was doing the hulls, I guess. And then we had the perfect play environment here with a kayak shop up the road. It was just incredible. So much easier than driving all the way to easily South Carolina so that you could then drive to the green of the Chattooga. Rock Island, it's right here. I mean, you can go paddle and be home in an hour.
Yeah, it's nice having that kind of a, for lack of a better, practice facility and right in your front yard.
Yeah. Yeah, right here where, my grandparents had a house and I'd been coming for my whole life. And I surfed here when I was a little kid. And then, inner tube the rapids. And so I've got a lot of family history here. My family comes up here on holidays and still comes up for weeks at a time during the summer to stay. So it's pretty cool that all of a sudden Eric Jackson moved in and started a kayak company.
Yeah, so do you remember the first days walking into the little, was it a laundromat?
Yeah, the wishy-washy.
The wishy-washy. You remember walking in there and all sitting around pitching ideas?
Yeah. I remember a lot of, even before that, just pitching ideas about how the kayaks are going to be different and how we're going to market them and how are you going to sell against a company like, Perception Dagger, who has, all this big roadshow and stuff. And, they had an RV, I think. Or he had one for Wave Sport, and I had one for Perception, and we were real used to traveling around and demoing boats. And so we just kind of like went for it. Really fun. Some interesting moments were trying to do a kayak with no holes in it. Mm-hmm. You just seemed adamant that we were going to do it, and the boats weren't going to leak at all. So we were going to be able to go kayaking all day and have dry socks at the end of the day. And the bulkhead was just such a hard thing. He got the seats working pretty good with those kiss offs and the drop down things. And then the bulkhead was just being so trying. And I was just finally like, I just don't think this is working. It's not working enough to risk the whole kayak company on something failing. And all of a sudden that Unishock thing just happened. It was just like put the foam on it a little bit bigger, make the track a little bit bigger. And all of a sudden it worked and it added a little bit of weight, but it was a shock absorbing bulkhead that left no screw holes through the kayak. And we could literally, especially back with our mountain surf kayaks, we could go paddle in a dry deck at Rock Island for an hour and a half and get out and your socks were dry. It was the coolest thing ever. So it was kind of cool to think that, the designs people can argue one way or the other about whether they're better or not, but they came in a lot of different sizes. But there were some aspects of them, like the no holes and the lightweight construction. It was a better product. I'm not a very good salesman. I'm not very good at, like, I don't like trying to sell something they don't necessarily need, because I kind of like the idea that don't, you know, if you don't need things, don't have them. There's plenty of stuff in this world you don't need at all. But it was really fun to think that I think this is actually just a better kayak. I can really put my my energy behind trying to convince people to buy our boat instead of something else, because I was like, I think your day's going to be better because you're not going to have to do in all those, you know, unthreading and gluing and rethreading all the screws in your kayak only to be wet and having to stop and dump your boat all the time anyway. That's just lame. So much better if you can kayak, you know, a really long run. Like I love doing like all of Man's Creek top to bottom. And then you wear the same socks on. You know, I think there's still a lot of companies who can't do that. And I'm just kind of like, it's so weird that it didn't catch on because it's such a great thing. And that was, you know, that was one little aspect of Jackson Kayak that was better. So it was really fun to promote that.
That's a neat thing. It takes me back. It like, it resonates with a lot of the conversations that we have in our different peer groups at Jackson. You know, it's always that why, and really you just said something right there, I think, that really hits home with the why for you. And you know, it's something simple. You know, it's make a really nice dry kayak. Do you want to try it? I mean, your socks are dry.
Yeah.
It's so simple. It's so simple, but it's a great why.
Yeah,
why you believed.
And there has to be a reason. I think. There has to be a reason why we're going to make more plastic toys to put into the world. You could say plenty of people are doing it. What's the point? We don't have to, you know, throw more plastic into the world. But once you realize that, you know, especially with the EJ and David and just the experience that I've had, it was fun working with Rana and recognizing that these guys who were, I would definitely say Graham and those guys were just blowing minds with all the things they were willing to try and create. And I had something to offer, which kind of surprised me at first, I think. My understanding of that came slowly. I think I would just complain like crazy about little things that they didn't recognize. Like, you know, the bulkhead screws were these big flathead things. And so if you hit your hand on them during certain tricks, you would bleed. There was a thing on the elbow on some of them where if you were on a rudder bouncing down a big cascade, you could hit it right on your elbow and it would just immobilize your whole arm for the rest of the slide. There was all these little things that was going on in kayaks that people had to worry about as much anymore. And I just grown up kayaking and been kayaking every day, or not every day in college, but every day a lot, so much that it just seemed like the refining stages hadn't happened yet. So somebody would have a really nice design and they'd be like, oh my God, this boat is so sick. Look at, you can spin on the waves. You can do all this other stuff. And I'd be like, yeah, but you like take your fingernails off when you roll because of the stupid screw in the wrong place. And all of a sudden I recognized that there was a value to that. Noticing when you put it on your shoulder that there's this sharp place that digs into your arm. That's got to go. This is stupid. If you're going to head carry, you can't get your head in it and not have these screws digging into your back. I mean, there was just so much stuff that just the guys who were designing kayaks weren't thinking of because they weren't the ones who were using them every day. And so they weren't getting, like when we came up with the Jackson ropes, it seemed like such a great idea. But real quickly, it was like, oh man, you better tuck in your rash guard. Because if you use it every day for a week, you could get chafed. And once you get chafed and you're wet every day, it's not going away.
Yeah.
That was kind of a fun phase of recognizing that I had something to offer simply by kayaking all the time. Not necessarily whether I was winning a rodeo or winning a race or understanding water in a different way, but simply because I was so used to using these products and such a complainer, you know, such a, you know, nothing's ever right. But there's a value to that, of being the person who, you know, finds the pee in the under the mattress, or notices that the zipper should not go quite up to here because otherwise it's going to pinch. You know?
It's just life now, experience, right? The old knowledge versus wisdom.
Yeah. I mean, somebody's out there making these cars do all sorts of super comfy, super nice things. I was riding in Nick's truck last night and he turned on the massage chairs and we just like, oh my God, somebody actually put a massager in the chair. That is next level. I would never have thought to ask for that, but boy, isn't it nice.
Oh yeah.
I can imagine, especially as much as a lot of you guys drive. You mean that would be a nice feature to have.
Yeah, half the time you're working out super hard and playboating your brains out. And by the time you get in the car to drive home, you're just like dying. To turn the massagers on, it was like, this is just crazy. It's designed for kayakers.
So when you look back at the history of all this stuff, man, and all the different boats that you've been in, like, is there one that you keep in the collection at home that you're never going to get rid of? You're never going to take it to the factory to meet the wood chipper. What's the one boat that just it's going to stay in the collection?
There's a lot right now, and I'm getting ready to sell some, but I'm in the a lot phase right now. I still have my Bigfoot, not my first squirt boat, but like my third or fourth squirt boat, but I won a world championships in 97 in it. And mainly the artwork is just so beautiful. I freaking love it. I don't actually like the boat performance anymore, but so many good memories of that. I bought it from Risa, paddling with those guys, taking on the upper yacht and running a lot of hard whitewater in it, and then having it work in a freestyle competition. So I keep that one. I've got a stunt bat, which I did take out and paddle. I thought I'd do a cool video of paddling really old gear. So the stunt bat's like the first freestyle kayak designed especially for that, not river running. It was just terrible. I couldn't stern squirt it. I just about flipped on the eddy line. I could barely get in it. So uncomfortable. So I have that one because of the memories that are associated with it. Like, I can remember doing stern squirts and doing bow squirts and like bow splatting postage due on the golly and all this cool stuff that was just like, I cannot believe that I can do this. You know, it's really fun when someone hands you a tool that lets you do more than you've ever been able to done on the river. It's like, blows your mind. It's like, wow, I'm suddenly better because someone gave me a different kayak. This is great. So that I've got that one. I've got a 214 Rockstar. Simply because that boat, I thought we were able to make it so light and it's just such a good basic design that I had a lot of leaps and bounds in my paddling performance and paddled it at the 213 Worlds in OC. I've got a carbon version of that one that I took to Uganda twice and paddled a lot of big waves on. What else am I holding on to? Oh, I went and got a wave hopper. I bought my friend Colleen's wave hopper from West Virginia because we had so much fun back in the days when racing was getting hot, and suddenly having a full-on no-rocker wild water boat. Had such a good time on the gully in that thing, and that's what I'm paddling on flat water right now. I've got a fiberglass flat water boat, but that wave hopper just has way better memories to it. So I don't have a Micro 230. That would be amazing to have, that 7.5-foot creek boat. It's pretty wild to suddenly use your one boat for creek boating and for play boating. So I won some rodeos in it, which was crazy. It loops awesome, and you can still kind of cartwheel it, but then you can take it on Man's Creek. And that was really groundbreaking for me to have a different tool than everyone else had. So people would be saying like, oh, this rapid is really scary. You've really got to make this boof, and it's a really tight turn at the bottom. And I would just be like, I probably don't even need to look at it. Boofing is so easy and turning is so easy for me. You know, it was the bigger stuff was scary still, but the tight stuff and the technical stuff, we just really kind of with a crew at the time kind of took things to the next level because of that boat. It was just easier to paddle. We could boof 30-foot waterfalls and land flat as a pancake, and it didn't hurt at all. So we started just running all these waterfalls and stuff that everyone else had been, you know, having really savage impacts, and it just landed soft, big V-hull. That was a beautiful boat. Yeah, there's a lot of them. I really am happy about our current lineup with Jackson Kayak. That's, I mean, I'm not supposed to say that, whatever. But honestly, that new Rockstar is better, and the Antix 2 is just my favorite boat for the Gali that I've ever paddled in my life. And then you get the Nirvana, which as I'm getting older, I think my level of fear goes up a lot. I'm just a lot more worried about a tree. Unexpected trees have wiped out a lot of good kayakers, or, you know, pinned a lot of good kayakers. And I've just gotten more and more scared about trees, because that's one of these things you can't really control. You can see the water, you can know the line, but you don't know if there's going to be a tree in it. So it's this weird random factor that I'm starting to get really annoyed by. And so the Nirvana floats a little bit higher on the water, and it's 9 foot, so it will bridge, you know, it will bridge the gap, and you don't have the big dead zone in the landing like you do on the 7.5 foots. You can travel out and land more where you can see better, but also it doesn't go underwater very much. A lot of bow rocker, but also a big fat hull. And so unless the tree is, you know, within 6 or 8 inches of the surface, you don't have to worry about it as much. So I'm really loving the idea that I'm enjoying even class 3-4 rarely run creeks again, because it just seems like that boat adds a little bit bigger layer of safety than I've had in a while.
Nice. Yeah, and I think one of the coolest projects that's translated from you guys over to us on the fishing side has been the Coosa X. And while it's what you guys would consider a behemoth of a boat, and it is a big boat, it's amazing to see and feel that boat and see some of the geometry on the sides of it, where it's really got some different hard angles to cut and lock in. And it's like, it's one of those boats that I've said it since we've brought it out. It can paddle flat water, but my gosh, when you put that boat on moving water, it's like the entire hull becomes alive and just starts to, it's like it hits its environment and it's supposed to be there. It's really incredible. And it's neat. It's because it is a big boat, but at the same time, it does have some of those items that carried over from you guys and really developed a really cool product, I think, for anglers.
Years and years ago, I mean, over 20 years ago, maybe 30 years ago, I remember saying somebody, they were saying that kayaks are like tennis rackets. You know, at this point, the technology is done, and whatever it is, you can make them a little bit bigger, you can make them a little bit smaller, you can make them a little bit lighter, but pretty much we're done. And I just remember chuckling to myself and thinking, because they were paddling for a different company and, you know, working for a different company. I was like, if you think that, I'm not going to tell you any different, but you don't even, I couldn't imagine thinking that kayaks were done, you know, the way that tennis rackets are done. Cause I was just like, I have so many ideas that I don't know what they're going to do or if they'll work or what we could do. And just in the past 10 years, we've seen them, you know, drop from like 13 feet to 10 feet to 7.5 feet. All of a sudden it was like, oh my God, you know, Corin was doing all his crazy ironing board things and people were doing all this crazy stuff. And so it's kind of neat to think that, we can get to a point where this particular style is almost tapped out. But there's so many different styles and there's so many different things that you can do with whitewater, ways to enjoy whitewater. Somebody said just the other day, they were like, I think all the tricks have been invented already. You know, it's just like, oh my God, you know, I am not nearly as creative as I used to be. But anybody who's as creative as we were at that point is going to come up with the next new thing, and I'm going to have to learn it. I just think there's a whole huge future of changing the boats to make it easier in every way. I don't think that we are tapped out in what we can do. So I can see this Coosa X could possibly be better in every single way. at fishing. It could be faster in the flats, plus easier, plus lighter, or plus just more convenient. It could have just a refined ride. You know, the difference in riding a go-kart or a Lexus. There's so many different ways that these things are improving. In the fishing world, I'm not using the product, so I don't have a lot of feedback on that. But it's going to get to where we have, maybe not massage seats, but something.
We start getting the massage seats, you'll see a lot of our type out on the water asleep.
We're going to have a little panel and a big fat battery.
Yep.
Yeah.
Big old
yeah.
fat battery. That'll get rid of some volume for us. But, well, Clay, we've made it an hour and 10 minutes. As we like to do with our guest on the Orion podcast, we want you to tell the folks at home where to find you on the socials, and also thank the people that's helped you along the way, any sponsorships, any types of things like that. And we'll let you send us on, bud.
Great. I would say my first shout out would go to my mom. For being open to the idea that because you like whitewater, you're going to get me into whitewater. And even if I say, oh, I hate this, I'm cold, I don't ever want to go again. And she would say, shut up and get in your car. This is what we do. This is what we're doing. Camp, or you can go in the kayak, but it's okay with me. We're a family and we do things together. And I like that. I think that worked out for me. Maybe it doesn't work out for everyone. It worked out for me. My stepfather, who taught me the most about water, my friend Don Ellis, who taught me a lot more about how to read the rapids and run them. Because I think my stepfather, he knew everything. And he taught me so much all the time, but it was, it was like having your dad tell you things. And suddenly when somebody else would chime in with a little kernel of knowledge, it was just so amazing to have new ideas dropping in from other people and then start to recognize, oh, there's, everybody in this group has something to offer me that I can learn from. Chris Bell introduced me to Woody and Risa. Always, forever, shout out to those guys. Doug Wells for talking to me about the joys of doing first ascents and how special it was to him to go off and do that. Bo Akins for just being a total asshole and getting on the water more than anyone else and just always not accepting no for an answer. And just everyone would say, this is impossible. Or the water's too high. Or the water's too low. He's like, I'm going boating. I'm just going, I don't care what you think. I'm just going boating. And that was really, really good for your paddling. Cause there's a lot of people out there who look for any excuse to not go paddling. And if you want to go paddle, if the river's too high, you're going to portage a lot. If it's a little too low, you might have to scrape with your hands and push some things, but you can still go paddle. So that was a really good lesson. EJ for teaching me a lot about competition and just for always being willing to go. BJ Johnson, current videos, travel, Alan Braswell. Yeah, so many different people in my life have helped me with my paddling or just my opportunities to out and go paddling. It's hard. It's a really, really big list. Then there's, Stephen Wright making me go squirt boating again, which was huge. I thought I didn't like squirt boating anymore after I hyperextended my knees. It just wasn't quite as fun, but he just seemed to be having so much fun all the time that I just had to give it another shot. And now I really love it again. That's a super good thing.
Nice.
Nice, man. So, yeah, dude, we thank you for being last minute guest tonight. We had some changes that happened. Our sales rep Spencer was going to be on. His family got sick, and man, you stepped up, and I enjoy talking to you. I can't wait till we can do it again, sitting around maybe in Kentucky again with another bottle of bourbon, maybe a Rock Island. You never know. You never know. Our paths will undoubtedly cross again soon, Clay.
Undoubtedly.
Well, we thank you guys for listening. We will be back in a couple weeks with the Orion podcast and a brand new guest. Check us out March 19th, right here, somewhere in our Jackson Kayak network of networks. We're streaming somewhere.
Streaming.
Always.
Always.
Yeah. Always. Check us out on Spotify. Yeah, Spotify. Everywhere but Apple, because Zach and I can't figure it out.
We'll see you guys. We'll get there eventually.
Eventually, one of these days. Maybe before.